James isn't here this week.
We're sad.
We are very sad about it.
We love him. He'll be back next week.
We have an amazing interview.
Amazing interview with two fierce lawyers that work at the Immigrant Defenders Law Center. And they are going to dive into some really amazing information around the whole immigration conversation.
Alana Holt and Sophia Corona.
Yeah.
So, stick around for that. Yeah. Before we get into it today, we just wanted to address something. A listener emailed us, and we do respond to the emails.
So we're really excited for all the other emails we'll receive.
Yes, and the listener called us out on using ableist language because we called Donald Trump crazy. They made a lot of wonderful points, and that the idea that crazy is sort of an excuse for his behavior, which is racist and sexist and xenophobic, and by calling him crazy we're sort of giving him cover, which is something we never want to do for this administration. So we wanted to apologize to that listener and to anyone else that we offended,
and also it's just a good reminder to think about we touch on this in our interview too, about how we get used to hearing language and don't necessarily understand what is implied when that happens. So
we're growing with you, and please always keep us in check, because we genuinely do appreciate it.
So thanks for the feedback.
Thank you.
Let's jump into the Women's March.
Yeah, let's do it.
I went yesterday in LA. It was so much fun. I think the organizers, we had the honor of interviewing Emiliano last weekend, who's one of the co-executive directors of the Women's March LA. And it was amazing. It was really great. I think they kind of restructured where the stages were and where we were actually walking. And so, I mean, it was tight because there was a lot of people there, which is the point. But it was really fun.
It was really
well run. We had amazing speakers both at Pershing Square, where we started, and down by City Hall. One of our someone else we interviewed, Lindsay Horvath.
Oh, was there?
Yeah, she was there. She spoke around like 10 o'clock at Pershing Square, and she came on for like 30 seconds to a minute and was like, "I'm a nasty woman because boom. I'm a nasty woman because boom." And it was like so good.
Oh, that's
so
awesome.
To the point. So that was fun.
I was on a set somewhere, and it wasn't my call. It was a scheduling thing. I wanted to be there. So I didn't want to say out loud that I wasn't there, but then it came out. So now here we are.
It's full transparency is good, especially as a straight white male.
Sure.
I appreciate your solidarity from set.
Yeah. And I was there last year, and I'll be there in the future.
Every other year. And there's always, that's one thing we talked a lot about with Emiliano last week, is that the Women's March is there. So far it's been an annual event, but that's not necessarily going to be the case forever. They're still kind of figuring out what's best as they go forward, but they have a lot of other initiatives cooking.
By the way, I want to make a really quick thing on our email, because we were just talking about the emails. I think somebody signed our podcast up for Donald Trump notifications.
That is hilarious.
That's pretty funny.
That's really funny.
We've been getting a lot of DonaldTrump.com, DonaldJTrump.com. emails, which is a lot of fun, because he puts out those surveys and I'm allowed to tell him fuck you
in the
survey. These surveys. So thank
that
you.
Is
thank
whoever you, prankster. That was. You're such a good prankster, and we love a good prank.
Oh.
Anyway, so a little bit of recap, just specifically in the Women's March. There's obviously a bunch of news source covered it, and there's all of the numbers of protesters in various cities are being updated over the past few days. There was 200,000 in New York. There was LA was reported online as like 500,000, but then I stayed to the end and someone was like, we were up to 600,000. So
that's great.
All those numbers are still coming out. And I think in general, the overarching theme I can see from my research is that in total, it's less than last year, but it is definitely still a very high number. And so it was exciting to see that people weren't just like, okay, we did that, check. Because clearly there's a lot of things we still need to talk about as it relates to women.
And for the record, you know, I was not there, but that doesn't mean that because there were less people there that the movement has lessened. You have to remind yourself that 600,000 people turned out a year into a presidency because it's such a shit show.
Yeah. And I think one of the overarching themes, and this is in a USA Today article, and also many other articles, but one of the themes we saw in signage was definitely grabbing by the midterms. it was on signage in Los Angeles. I saw pictures of it in many other cities. And basically that was their national approach this year, is that we have to focus, we as women, and we as like women allies, have to support on the midterm elections upcoming. And so second in Las Vegas today, the 21st, which is Sunday, they launched a national voter registration tour, which is going to continue until basically you can't register to vote in various swing states mm-hmm. and whatnot. So it's pretty exciting to see that they're translating a super conceptual, of course, women need to be equal to men, to yeah. this. The first thing we're tackling is voter registration, which yeah. is a reasonable first step, I think, and pretty exciting. So I hope if you all went to your various women's marches, you had a good experience. You met some fun people and are going to stay engaged moving forward.
Yeah, and I think, too, one of the things they talked about, you know, piggybacking on that, of running for office, this was like a big part of the Women's March this year. And they brought up, there was a New York Times article that brought up Ashley Bennett, who was a Democrat from Egg Harbor Township, New Jersey. She unseated a longtime local Republican politician in her first campaign for office in November. She ran for Atlantic County Freeholder against John L. Carman after he posted a meme on Facebook during last year's march asking, "Will the women's protest be over in time for them to cook dinner?" So she ran against him and she won, and it was her first time running. If you want to get involved, you can check out groups like Indivisible. Run for Something is super important. We interviewed Amanda Littman about a couple months back,
yep.
I guess. That's amazing. Run for office yeah. anywhere.
And also Run for Something just released, I think last week, their updated strategic plan. So you can kind of take a look at where that organization is going. Amanda spoke with us a little bit about it, but it was exciting to see that. Yeah, and then of course, alongside the march, there's always a little bit of criticism involved. I think that something that I've heard, being from Georgia and having Republican friends, a lot of people are like, the march is all about abortion. And I'm like, no, it's not at all. And we want, you know, we obviously want people that are pro-choice to come to, or pro-life to come to the marches and to meet us and talk to us about why they're pro-choice and engage in that conversation and not feel alienated. Because it truly is, again, like Emiliano said last week, it's not about, she said bluntly, she was like, it's not about Republicans or Democrats. It's not about that. It's about the fact that women are essentially treated as a minority. And this movement is about addressing those issues, having those conversations, and trying to figure out the next steps to change the fact that we, you know, the equal pay gap and
I do hope
representation
too, though,
in office and all of the above.
I will say, and some, you know, from this New York Times article, they were interviewed, like this woman named Nadia Agrawal. She said she joined the rally in Washington this year, but she said, it isn't what I thought it would be. It felt like more of a commiseration rather than the start of a lot of work. And I think that the Women's March sort of addressed that a little bit this year
yeah,
by turning
it
into.
So
but I think that, you know, I hope that, and it was brought up later, you know, I hope that when there's a Black Lives Matter rally, it has just as much importance as
yep.
the Women's March rally. And I hope that those of you guys listening, if we're going to these marches in solidarity with women, we should be going in solidarity with our with people of color, and we should be going in solidarity for anything and everything. It's sort of an all hands on deck moment.
Yep,
immigration
exactly.
rights, which we'll get into later on with Sophia
yep.
and Alana. That's important.
Yeah.
So I think if we're going to make this, you know, bigger and better,
yep.
that's where it needs to
exactly.
go.
Exactly. And then one quick thing that I was excited to see when I was like scrolling through Twitter this past week is, I remember last week when I was like, they should spend less money on their dresses at the Golden Globes because blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
Time's Up has officially partnered with eBay to auction off those dresses. So.
Oh.
There's an article in The Telegraph about that. So just wanted to acknowledge that because I was bitching about it last week.
Yeah.
Anyways,
let's
in
go,
other news,
let's
as
go to
you
the government
all know,
shutdown. Guys, first
TikTok.
Of all, we should say that We Rebel has not been furloughed. We will be still.
Yeah, don't worry.
We will still be recording
don't
during
worry.
The shutdown.
I know you were all concerned.
I know a lot of people were scared about whether we were going to do it. I can't speak for the other political podcasts.
I can't.
I don't know what they're doing.
We'll see.
But we're going to press on in this shutdown. So there was a CNN, such a dumb joke. There was a CNN article by Daniel Diaz
James
and Kevin
will
Liptak.
Be mad at us about
yeah,
that.
For
it's
sure.
Cool, though. It's fine.
It's titled, "You'll Get Your Mail But Not Your Passports. Here's What's Affected by the Shutdown." So thousands of federal employees will be placed on furlough, meaning they won't report to work on Monday. Whoever works for agencies and departments that are considered non-essential, including agencies that pay out small business loans and process passport requests, will cease to work effective immediately until Congress is able to agree on a bill for the federal budget. Just got my passport. Whew. At the peak of the 2013...
Oh, mine's expired in August.
Yeah, well...
Well, hopefully it won't.
Who knows?
Who knows?
At the peak of the 2013 government shutdown, about 850,000 employees were furloughed per day, according to the Office of Management and Budget. The military is considered essential and will stay reporting for duty. However, the troops, including those in combat, will potentially not be paid during a shutdown. This is problematic because Senator Claire McCaskill, who is a Democrat from Missouri, made an effort shortly after midnight to get the troops' salaries and death benefits paid through the shutdown, saying, "I want to make sure that tonight we send a very clear signal that we don't want one moment to pass with there being any uncertainty of any soldier anywhere in the world that they will be paid for the valiant work they do for our national security." Mitch McConnell, resident turtle, representing Kentucky, scuttled the effort, objecting to her motion. In 2013, when the government was shut down, Obama signed a last-minute bill which authorized paychecks for troops and some Defense Department workers and contractors. That they're doing this,
yeah.
It's so problematic and such an issue. In 2013, they paid soldiers that were fighting abroad during a shutdown. So now Trump and Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell and all of this Republican wing are pretending like they care about troops and caring about America and its placement in the world. There are people that are putting their lives on the line
and it's also
fighting
just,
wars and that are not getting paid.
It's also crazy that a Democrat from Missouri brought up paying military and then resident turtle, a Republican, was like, hell no.
Yeah.
It's like, I mean, that's the flag that the Republicans constantly wave.
They're trying
to
pin it on Dems.
Yeah. Is they're like, you know, armed forces, armed forces, armed forces. Democrats don't care about armed forces. And it's like, well, but can you, what?
Right. And then it goes, so then there's another article by Dylan Matthews from Vox where he writes, this is the first government shutdown under one-party government ever.
Yes.
And he writes,
I thought that was a really interesting fact.
Yeah. Yeah. They control both houses. The government shutdown this weekend is the first time a true, honest-to-God shutdown has happened with a single party controlling the White House and Congress. Some Republicans will bring this up. It's true that Jimmy Carter and the Democrats in Congress...
Jimmy Carter, pod favorite.
Pod favorite. Butted heads five separate times in 1977, 78, and 79 and couldn't get their act together to fund the government. But that was before Carter's attorney general issued guidance saying that when a funding gap like this exists, government functions must shut down. So you can make an argument that if a shutdown was a true threat back in the day, the Carter administration might not have gone through a government shutdown.
Right.
Right.
But that's like, you know, if you could, you know, make an argument.
Yeah.
So we're just going to go ahead with the fact that this is the first.
Another point that they
shutdown.
Bring up is, so Republicans right now are trying to call it the Schumer shutdown. It's the Trump shutdown, 100%. And they're trying to make it seem like Democrats are shutting down the government. And Democrats, you know, no mistake about it. Democrats are not voting right now on a resolution that doesn't include DACA, which is the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. This is it. This is where Democrats are making their stand right now. And they're saying no funding for the wall. And we want this codified into law because Trump took it away, I believe, in March of last year. Or I'm sorry, it will end in March 2018.
Yep, of this year.
And they're trying to make it seem like Democrats are the ones steering the entire shutdown. Only 45 Republican senators voted on what was proposed as to pass the federal budget. Only 45 of them. So even if Democrats didn't vote, they didn't even have the votes in the Republican Party.
Right.
This is Trump's inability to get his own party
behind him
to stop a shutdown. Yep. So while they want to blame Democrats, I'm sorry, but proof is in the pudding.
Trump shutdown. There's another really good article that covers how this all happened. If you haven't been following it along the way or not understanding the different intersections that are going on, it's in Time. It's called How the Government Broke Down. It's by Philip Elliott and Nash Jenkins. So that's a good one to look up if you're in need of more info.
Yeah. Okay, so let's move on to
my
Russia.
Least favorite topic. Let's just whiz through this.
So Steve Bannon
as I
was subpoenaed
every week.
Steve Bannon was subpoenaed by special counsel and House committees to the House committee to testify on Russia probes. This is from a Washington Post article by Karun Demirjian, Carol
Another
D. Leonick,
favorite.
And Rosalind S. Helderman. Special counsel Robert Mueller's office has subpoenaed former White House chief strategist Stephen K. Bannon to appear before a grand jury, a move that indicates his broad investigation into Russia's interference in the 2016 campaign is far from wrapping up. The subpoena was issued last week, according to a person familiar with the situation who has said that Bannon expects to be able to persuade the special counsel's office to accept a voluntary interview of Bannon by prosecutors in place of a grand jury appearance. the news of Mueller's action. Oh boy. Which was
we'll get onto it.
You said Mueller for weeks.
I did not.
The
I said
news
it twice.
Of Mueller's action, which was first here. Reported by the New York Times, came on the same day that the House Intelligence Committee also issued a subpoena for Bannon for refusing to answer a range of questions from investigators during a combative closed-door interview frustrating members of both parties who are probing the Trump campaign's alleged Russia ties. This is kind of a big moment.
It is.
If Mueller is bringing Bannon in front of a grand jury, I was reading about this, and listeners correct me if I'm wrong about this, but when you bring someone before a grand jury, they are allowed to plead the fifth if it's in relation to themselves. If there's incriminating evidence on themselves, they are allowed to plead the fifth, but they are not allowed to refuse to answer if it is in relation to criminal charges of somebody else or somebody that they might be associating with. So if Steve Bannon...
Such as, would we
say...
President DT.
So if he refuses to answer questions, he could potentially be held in contempt of court. And if he's convicted of that, he could be put in jail. There's a really interesting article I was reading that talked about how this happened, I believe in 2009, where somebody was held in contempt of court and they were put in jail for a couple of months until they agreed to answer questions. Who knows if that'll happen?
We'll see.
But they're going to make him chat.
Did I miss you say if there's a date? Did I miss a date in the news?
For the subpoena?
Yep.
No, I don't believe there's a set date.
Okay. Well, I'm excited to hear about when that date is.
Yeah.
Even though I don't want to talk about Russia ever again, but, you know.
We're going to have to talk about it.
We're going to have
so
to
much.
Talk about it next week.
Let me see if I can find where this... whatever.
whatever. Anyways, on to general fuckery.
And just sort of bad news.
And
this
just bad
just
news.
General
but
bad
this
news.
Is also, like, not very shocking. So
right, but we'll
article.
Follow it up with good news
yeah,
in
we
a
will.
Second.
Don't worry. Good news and a great interview.
You want to fast forward?
No, don't fast forward.
I'm just kidding. Just do the bad news part. It's going to be, like, 2 minutes.
Yeah. Anyways, so basically there was an article written by John Sharman titled Landmark Human Rights Report singles out Donald Trump for encouraging oppression around the world, which is not shocking to anybody. Let's be honest.
Sure.
We all kind of knew this was happening. But in the article, they talk about basically how he doesn't support anything related to human rights. Do we need to pull out anything specific about that? I don't think so.
I don't believe so.
Okay, great. Okay. And then there's another article that's really interesting to read. It's in NPR. It's written by Danielle with a beautiful last name that I'm going to murder.
Kurtzleben.
Thank you, Nick.
Kurtzleben.
And it's titled How America Has Changed During Trump's First Year in Office by the Numbers. So there was a lot of talk yesterday at the Woman's March about how we were exactly a year of inauguration and all these different things about, you know, what has changed, that kind of thing. And so it was a good article. It goes through some numbers involved with economy, environment, international affairs, health policy, general politics, meaning referring to just the party interactions with data attached to it and also some diagrams that are really interesting to look at. And so what they say in this article that I think is important to keep in mind is though, even though we're looking about how the country has changed throughout the first year, this isn't to say that the president created these outcomes, right? So mm-hmm. wages, for example, determined more by worker supply and demand than by the ripple effects of who's in the White House. So anyways, it's still good to have a clear picture of what's going on. And so I highly suggest everyone look into that. Moving on to good news.
Why not? So House Democrats introduced a bill to legalize marijuana and provide restorative justice to communities impacted by the war on drugs. This is a Business Insider article by Jeremy Burke. Where he writes that a group of House Democrats on Wednesday introduced a bill to legalize marijuana at the federal level and expunge federal convictions for marijuana use or possession. The bill, introduced by Reps Barbara Lee and Ro Khanna of California and sponsored by 12 House Democrats, is a companion to Senator Cory Booker's Marijuana Justice Act, introduced in the Senate last year. Beyond removing marijuana from the Controlled Substances Act list, which is a travesty that it is. It's classified, I think, as a class one drug alongside heroin, or it's above heroin. The bill proposes going a step further to provide restorative justice to communities disproportionately affected by marijuana arrests and convictions and create an inclusive industry from the ground up, Lee said in a Wednesday afternoon call with reporters. The bill proposes creating a $500 million community reinvestment fund to focus on job training for the nascent cannabis industry, prioritizing communities that have a disproportionate number of marijuana arrests and convictions, as well as expunge convictions related to use or possession. The bill would also cut federal funding for law enforcement and prison construction in states found to be disproportionately arresting or convicting low-income residents or people of color for marijuana offenses. This is a problem that has gone back for years and years and years, from the war on drugs, from the Reagan administration up until now.
Yep.
Marijuana is going to be legalized. It is a multi-billion dollar industry, and I think that we should stop fighting it.
Yeah. So another piece of good news. I don't know if anyone listening has been to rural Wisconsin, but I have, and it's an interesting place to go. It's actually quite pretty, very cold. But there was an article in The Economist about, it's titled The Blue Ripple, and Democrats pull off a surprise win in rural Wisconsin. So basically, this woman named Patty Shatner won a state senate that has been held by the Republican Party since 2000, which is really exciting because that is now 18 years ago. But they go on to report the governor seemed a little frantic on the evening of January 16th. He began with no fewer than 8 tweets with an all caps wake up call after it became clear that this historically red district in a rural western region of the state had voted for a Democrat in a special election for a state Senate seat. So it's another one of those things that we always point back to this, especially Nick, like there are more of us and all of these little elections ladder up really quickly. And so it's exciting to keep in mind.
I think too, she talks about this now new state Senator Shatner talked about how she didn't talk about how bad of a person Trump is,
yep.
which you can do. I think she focused on the issues. And I think that that's important because we always say this, but Trump is a symptom of the disease. He is not all-encompassing. She is now a state senator in the state that is run by Scott Walker, the state that is represented by Paul Ryan. there are tons and tons of people on the right and Republicans that are doing Trump's bidding and have been doing and, you know, being part and taking part of the policies that Trump is putting forth far before he was even the president or sniffed the nomination. And she talked about issues that were affecting her community, much like Danica Rome, who is, you know, the first transgender representative in the House of Representatives in Virginia. She talked about things that were happening in her town and did not make it about how much of a piece of shit Trump is, which you can. But I think that that's an important thing for going forward, especially in purple to, you know, light red, light pink zones.
Yeah. And it's just, it goes back to, I feel like the common theme of our candidates to get excited about is truly that they're like, sure, they're obviously usually against Trump, but they're really focusing on what's relevant to their immediate constituents rather than just bashing Trump, because it's like you don't really get much from that.
Yeah,
that's already obviously happening.
That could be like question one, like thoughts on Trump. And it's like bad. And it's okay, cool. Let's move on
to what's actually going. So, anyways,
we'll cover our candidate to watch this week. This is kind of important because his election is coming up on January 23rd, which is 2 days from now, but 1 day from tomorrow when you're listening to this. His name is Austin Davis, and he is running for state representative in Pennsylvania's 35th district. Again, his election is January 23rd. So if you are in Pennsylvania and you are listening to this podcast, try and help out his campaign. If you are in the 35th district, vote. If you want to donate and you are not, you know, at all near there, you can go to www.davisforpa.com, where it talks about what he's involved in and what matters to him. He's very big on jobs. He's very big on education. He's very big on public safety and transportation. And to give you a little bit of a backstory of him. This is from his website, but at an early age, Austin knew that he wanted to dedicate his life and career to public service. When he was in high school, he founded and served as the chairman of the mayor's youth advisory council. After graduating high school, he attended the University of Pittsburgh, where he earned a degree in political science. While he was in college, he was hired as a legislative intern by the Pennsylvania House of Representatives. And at the age of 21, the Tribune Review called him a veteran at the politics of helping others.
At 21. When the rest of us were just getting drunk. He's currently serving as the vice chairman of the county Democrat committee, and he's on the board of directors of the YMCA in Greater Pittsburgh, the Consortium for Public Education, Communities and Schools of Pittsburgh and Auburn. What is that city? Another city. anyway, so that's in 3 days, 2 days, 1 day, if you're listening, whenever you're listening, or maybe you're listening after and he's won, and wouldn't that be exciting?
That'd be exciting.
Moving on. So I think that's everything as far as news this week. It was a pretty happy week for us, I feel.
Well,
you know, we just whizzed through the shutdown. But that, anyways.
Yeah. I'm sure we'll talk about
things
that next
good
week.
Or bad, because they're all much more complicated. Sure. We talk about that in our interview.
We'll decide them as victories and roadblocks. Because there's no losses these days.
No losses.
Victories and roadblocks.
All right. Stick around for our two guests, Sophia Corona Almeida. I keep doing that to people's last names. It's really a shame. I keep messing up people's last names. Anyways, and Alana Holt, they're both staff attorneys at the Immigrant Defenders Law Center.
My last name's Carterasi, so.
And mine's Wanzerski, so you think I'd be good at this thing, but I'm not.
But here we are.
Here we are.
Stick
I have
around.
Other skills. Stick around. Listen to our amazing guests. Thanks, y'all.
Bye.
Hey, y'all, welcome back to the second half of this week's episode. We're so excited. We have not only one, but two guests.
Two guests.
One, two. Both are staff attorneys at the Immigrant Defenders Law Center. We have Sophia Corona Almeida, who's on the phone with us, and we're so thankful. And then we have Alana Holt, who is a fellow Michigan alum with us, who's with us here in person. So thank you both for coming on. So I think we'll jump in with Sophia and with our first question, and we'll ask Sophia first, and then Alana, we obviously want your answer also. But Sophia, at what point in your life, what was the turning point where you knew you were an activist and you knew you had to go into this type of work?
Well, the roots really are in childhood. I come from a first generation farm worker family. Grew up witnessing some pretty bad oppression, but I didn't know that's what it was. As children, we tend to normalize things we see all around our community, but things just didn't sit well, right? We still know things are wrong even before we can articulate them. But my really coming of age and came post 9/11, I was in my sophomore year of college and starting to get involved with things on my college campus and starting to get informed about comprehensive immigration reform. It might seem crazy now that at one point it seemed very possible. It was in the news. There was talk between President Bush and President Vicente Fox from Mexico and Congress being on board. And it all came crashing down after 9/11. As many of you know, 9/11 also represented a real dark turning point in this country for how we saw immigrants. They had been criminalized before, but, you know, especially our brothers and sisters that come from Arab countries really became vilified. And that really stayed with me and pushed me to become active on immigration, something that I knew was an issue, something I knew from growing up, but had never had the strong push or the words and the space to articulate it. And post 9/11, really, you know, there was a resistance that grew, and it really gave, it mentored me, it sheltered me. And then opened me to a whole new world of veteran activists that had been doing this, you know, their whole life for decades. And here we are now.
Right. Wow. I mean, that was a huge turning point for everyone, I think, in their lives. So it makes perfect sense that you would jump into action. So Alana, and you?
So I think my turning point began in college at the University of Michigan.
Go blue. We're contractually obligated.
We're just going to say
we have to say go blue every time it
comes up. I studied history and philosophy at Michigan, and I took a course on the penal system, the legal system in the United States. It was my first exposure to mass incarceration, just what it was, what was happening, and its links in U.S. history. And it was a pretty transformative time for me to understand not just currently the ways our government engages in mass oppression, but that it's a systemic oppression that dates back to the origins of this country. And so I was very moved by that, and I started to get involved in different projects around criminal justice reform in college. I volunteered at the Washtenaw County Women's Jail and did a creative writing program there. And that was my first taste of seeing that there was work to be done on the ground doing direct service, and that that was a means of affecting social change. And I think that it, as someone who myself has had a lot of privileges, grew up relatively sheltered, I've always felt very driven to be providing direct services and be directly involved with communities that are affected. And so that was kind of my position going into law school. And law school was, you know, another, you know, interesting exposure to the way that lawyers view their jobs or sort of their role in public service and civic service. I found in law school that as someone that was focused on, that was sort of known to be a public interest focused student, I was sort of relegated to this like niche group of, you know, law students who are like out there for the public good and like, you know, want to do things out of the goodness of their heart. And that was really frustrating to me because I felt like this should be a huge bulk of people coming out of law school. It should not be some rare choice. And a lot of that is wrapped up in loans and how it's how it can be really hard to go into public service as a lawyer. But I felt very strongly that it should be something that we should all just have a natural affinity for. It's something that we all carry a responsibility to do. And so that is what drove me to want to be a public defender, which was my first job out of law school. And I initially was a public defender in Miami for 3 years. And after a number of years representing a lot of people who were also simultaneously facing the threat of deportation because of their criminal case, I was then sort of exposed to this, you know, another world, and that to me seems even darker and more mysterious than the criminal justice system, which is the way that the immigration enforcement operates in this country, how, you know, an undocumented status is just fundamentally criminalized, and how easy, how seamless our government first criminalizes people of color, they criminalize poverty, and then subsequently just filter people in to deportation proceedings. And so a job came up at Immigrant Defenders Law Center, and I decided to make the shift from criminal defense to deportation defense about a year and a half ago. And so I started at IMDEF in August of 2016. It was a few months before the election, and it's been, I mean, an amazing time since then. And now I feel like I can never turn away from this fight for providing lawyers to immigrants.
I'm curious about the question for both of you guys, because you talked about, you know, the election in 2016, which happened. I'm curious if what the difference was, I mean, in looking, because, you know, Obama, for all of the good he did, was not the best, did not have the best track record on immigration. And I'm curious what the difference has been from an Obama administration to a Trump administration when addressing the problems that you guys have had. I know that you came in sort of at the tail end, but if you have contact with people at work, I mean, what has the atmosphere shift been like?
Well, I'll let Sophia start with that question because she's been doing this work a lot longer.
So I did start as an immigrant rights activist long before thinking of or reconciling with the law. And that was actually because even before really thinking of law school, I saw the limitations that direct services had. My issue with it was that deportations happened. I grew up with them, and I grew up with lack of access to attorneys. So what was the point if there was attorneys if people couldn't afford them or they weren't in your community? I grew up in the Central Valley of California, very rural, indigent area. And I also had the problem of what happens if the laws are not on your side. So what is even, you know, you come through all these hurdles, you access finding an attorney if you can even afford one, and a quality one of that, which is also a hurdle in our field. And the laws are just not on your side because they're so restrictive, as they are for the majority of undocumented people now in our country. There's just no way to legalize, given our current legal regime. And for years, I really, really did struggle with that. And when the election of Obama actually happened, I was then in law school. I was pretty radicalized at that time. I definitely was an anarchist, kind of grassroots social circles. And I was like, he's not going to change anything. This is gonna be the ongoing problem, because people are just so removed. We don't have the majority of the public on our side. And there was the continued vilification and kind of that paradigm in the conversation at the national arena. And things had been changing in California, but we were still far from where we needed to be. At that point, I was in Texas, and I saw it firsthand. I was like, whoa, like, this is, like, the middle of the country, and this, you know, we're still, like, where California was, like, you know, 10 years before. And sure enough, sadly, with the Obama administration, it continued, right? Activists called them the deporter-in-chief, which sounds so harsh now, but that's, you know, he really did ramp it up. He did. He did it as a tactic, and blood was on his hands. He did it thinking he could appease the Republicans. And obviously, we know it had tragic consequences and didn't appease them, right? They, in fact, we saw the rise of the Tea Party, and even more. They wanted more and more. And we really saw that this was underlying the issues were cultural wars, right? It was about America becoming browner. It was about white anxiety, much, much deeper issues that needed to be resolved in this country. And so I was kind of came into the law already knowing that, and knowing that we could do a little, but that little made a big difference. And so when I came in, I was like, look, activists are going to continue. I did direct organizing. I did direct activism. That needs to continue. I still support it. But I said, we need to also be in the courtroom. We also need to be representing people. We also need to be the ones drafting these laws. And so when the election happened, I was a two-year attorney that came directly with that agenda. I mean, I went into law school only for that, not, you know, I needed a better paycheck than an organizer for sure. But it was really because I thought I could make a difference, right? That if as a community we came together and there was a group of us, even if it wasn't many, but all these radical attorneys, that we could make a difference. And I started with working on deportation and detention. And it was few people that were doing that work, in the sense of how Alana was saying, in terms of who you think of, all this cadre of attorneys coming out of law school, and you think, like, wow. And it really is a small subset. And sadly, I have to say that actually, although the election was devastating, I was one of the few people in my social circle that saw it coming. Mm-hmm. I knew that this was an unresolved issue in America. And so I was sad and devastated, but I can't say I was completely shocked. It was shocked, but not, it was like, sadly, I could see this happening. Right. It was like, this is a turning point, and we're, you know, even all the numbers had to work out and so much stuff had to go wrong for this to happen. I could still sadly see it happening. And so I kind of just came in to the post-election, like, I had come out of maternity leave. I was like, you know what? This is a whole new world, but this is the world that we knew was going to happen, that we're going to have to confront and see as we're going to get over this hurdle. These underlying issues. And so even though things have been bad, I think they've been post-election, I think they were bad before. And now it's almost like it's just more visible. Now we just know the president's racist, right? We know that the issues underlying this dilemma have to do with much deeper, dark forces. Mm-hmm. That said, it is much worse, right? Alana and I are at the forefront. We see the numbers. Apprehension of people has ramped up. Apprehension of people that never would happen, right? The most kind of sympathetic people, they're now really, they're being picked up. They're being thrown into detention. Families are being separated. People that have no criminal history, people that have been here 10, 20 years, So we are in a dark time. I just also don't lose perspective that it's been kind of coming, and we just need to confront it head on.
Yeah, I think, Sophie, everything you just said is really important. It's just so important for people who are trying to wrap their minds around what's happening with the immigration enforcement system right now, which is that the whole structure of the system, the way that it seamlessly snatches people from the criminal justice system, the incredible, immense discretion that individual ICE agents have to decide on engaging in, you know, mass arrests or just individual actions where they can show up. All of that has structurally been part of our immigration system forever. And it's important for Democrats who are capitalizing on this anti-Trump moment to own what our immigration enforcement system has always looked like. And the fact that a lot of what Obama did that was positive for immigration was centered around things that, as the executive, he had discretion over. So he had discretion to, we believe, discretion to create deferred action for childhood arrivals. So that was something that he did not have to pass any legislation in order to defer deportation for those set of immigrants. And also things within the system, within the immigration courts itself, things like prosecutorial discretion, discretion on enforcement, not going after people, not arresting people who don't have certain types of criminal convictions. And we're now seeing that, you know, and with a new president, it's incredibly easy to undo all of that. And so what's incumbent on us in the future is to own the fact that we have an immigration enforcement system that is fundamentally has gone completely haywire, and it's been like that, and that that changing it requires legislation in Congress. We have to completely revamp our immigration laws to make it so that we can't, you know, we basically right now we have a system where, you know, federal law enforcement agents can, you know, wreak havoc on millions of people in our community. And reining that in is not something that just a president can do.
I'm curious, you mentioned DACA, and right now we are in the middle of a government shutdown, and Democrats are trying to coalesce around DACA and trying to get it codified into law. Is that far enough? I mean, is that the hill worth dying on, or should they go with comprehensive immigration reform fully? I mean, if we're willing to shut down the government, to take a stand on DACA, is that where, you know, is that a step in the right direction? I mean, obviously, but could it go further? And what do you guys think about that? Now that we're in the midst of it, I guess.
I mean, the position of immigration activists is all 11 million, right? Is it that our priority should not be with continuing to feed into the quote unquote good immigrant, bad immigrant narrative. And that is a lot of what has given DACA so much traction and so much attention, is that, you know, the way people phrase it is it's, you know, kids who came here through no choice of their own, as though choosing to come here without documentation is worthy of an enforcement action, is worthy of something that even immigration judges refer amounts to a death sentence for many people. So, you know, comprehensive immigration reform ought to be absolutely at the top of our agenda. I think in the context of this current crisis with the government shutting down and with DACA being the thing that's on the table, DACA being the most pressing, you know, there's this deadline in March. I think I understand where that, you know, where that decision lies, that we're pushing for it. And oftentimes change does have to come incrementally. But the conversation around comprehensive immigration reform for all 11 million undocumented people needs to be a bigger part of our conversation because of all the things that Sophia mentioned and that we've been talking about, which is that fundamentally the system is very broken.
Right. This is such, I mean, it's such a huge topic. I feel like I have questions for each silo we're kind of touching on, whether it's, you know, a good or a bad immigrant, or from this country or that country, or this age or that age. And so I'd kind of like to jump into, you know, how at the Immigrant Defenders Law Center, how do you kind of divide your strategy? And what are your programs that you're, you know, in your Children's Representation Project program, you're specifically working on X with the adults, you're working on X? Like, what is the strategy at your particular law center?
So the goal of Immigrant Defenders Law Center is ultimately to create essentially a public defender system for all immigrants facing removal in the Los Angeles area, which means that if you are in deportation proceedings, that you have that you get to be appointed an attorney. And the importance of having a lawyer in removal proceedings cannot be overstated. There's been multiple studies that show that immigrants who have a lawyer are 5 times more likely to be successful in their removal case, to get relief from deportation and be able to stay here with their families. Currently, 68% of immigrants who are detained in removal proceedings in California do not have an attorney. So filling in that gap is the primary goal of IMDEF. And currently we do focus our representation on unaccompanied minors who are in removal proceedings, as well as adults who have mental illness. And so they have mental disabilities that prevent them from representing themselves. So right now our programs focus mostly on immigrants that are the most vulnerable and in the most need of assistance, but there are a number of developments locally and statewide that are expanding the amount of people who will have a lawyer in removal proceedings. And that is part of, you know, California's position and the, you know, quote unquote resistance. So the LA Justice Fund is a citywide program that is going to fund representation for immigrants in removal proceedings. And Vere Institute of Justice just passed what they're calling the Safe Cities Initiative. And Santa Ana, California, was a recipient of one of those grants. And so we actually are setting up an office in Orange County to start representing immigrants in removal proceedings in Orange County. So we're trying to expand slowly the amount of people that we're able to help. But the fundamental goal of our organization is putting lawyers into courtrooms where there were not lawyers before, basically.
Mm. Wow.
And I don't know, Sophia, if you want to add on that.
Yeah, I mean, the reality is that immigration court life, the equal life sentences are set out as in the context of criminal court. And it's just shocking to most people who enter the field that you don't have a right to counsel. So in criminal court, thankfully, through court decisions, but also social action, there was a change. There wasn't always the right to counsel for indigents going through criminal proceedings. And we're just really overdue for that in the immigration context. The idea that you can deprive someone of liberty, right? Place them in a detention center that looks like prison, but has less rights. People don't even know that. They don't even have the same adequate library. They don't even have the same rights to sue when their rights are violated, the federal agents. I mean, it's just layered upon layered. And we also know that when you're detained, those people are rapidly through the a deportation process, that the majority end up being removed from this country, even though they have very likely a way to stay lawfully in this country. And the idea that you can put somebody in a black hole, right, where they're incommunicado, they don't have access to a lawyer, rights are being violated left and right, where they themselves have to talk to a judge and confront a government attorney, just is daunting. And the fact that they will be deprived of then their life to be here in the United States, you know, people that have been here again 10, 20 years, people that came here as children, people who face imminent death on the return, is again just an American tragedy that we definitely think in this generation, or at least that we're all working towards it changing in this generation. And just to add to what Alana said, Immigrant Defenders Law Center, we do direct representation, but we also are part of larger coalitions and collaboratives that are doing the organizing, that are doing the public policy work to get these new carve-outs of funding established. And it really is trying to build on the momentum that now there's new attention and light to the fact that, people face detention and deportation without even the right to counsel.
Right. And I think it's interesting also in this current era where it is, like you said earlier, it's just more visible. There's a lot of Democrats or progressive citizens that are like, yes, OK, we got to help the immigrants. We got to help the immigrants. And they don't know what that means. And so I'm curious from you two, you know, is there a specific story that you can point back to that allows people to understand it better as to what we can actually do? Or is there, you know, is there data? I mean, you gave us a few facts, Alana, but is there additional data that helps people understand the, like, the gross scale of this problem? You know, what's information we can give our listeners as, like, tools to move on?
I mean, I think one thing that's really important for people to do is educate themselves on what it looks like to be in deportation proceedings and what these courts look like, because they are operating largely in darkness. They are operating sort of shrouded in mystery. For instance, immigrants who are detained on the Los Angeles docket are currently at a prison in Adelanto, California, which is about 90 miles outside of Los Angeles. It's in the high desert. You literally have to drive through a mountain range to get there. This detention facility is operated by GEO, which is a private corporation. The immigration court is attached to this prison. So for people who do not have attorneys or people who have family members that live in Los Angeles, which most of them do, or all around Los Angeles, they have to drive. They have to make this, you know, really lengthy drive out just to be there for their family. The attorneys have to drive out there. So physically, they have literally hidden the system from the community that they are taking people from. And so it's important to sort of get an understanding of what that looks like, particularly for someone who has, many people who are in proceedings in Adelanto have traveled halfway around the world looking for asylum in the United States. And, you know, oftentimes I have to sit in court, and I'm right now only representing immigrants who have been found mentally incompetent. So I get appointed on cases as a safeguard for people who have these specific kind of psychosocial disabilities. But I sit in court and I watch, you know, person after person being called up in front of a judge, being spoken to through a translator, and the judge is, you know, summarily just deporting people or summarily denying bond. Wow. And it really is that there's a specific quote from the president of the Immigration Judges Union that a lot of what immigration courts look like amounts to death penalty trials in a traffic court setting. It's people whose lives are summarily being determined. And the only safeguard is the judge or the DHS attorney going through and seeing whether they qualify for any forms of relief. And they're not making the right calls. They are routinely violating people's due process rights. When this happens, when people are forced to go in front of a judge and they do not have a lawyer, they are the vast majority of the time having their rights violated, because there are likely available forms of relief and they are incapable of asserting those forms of relief. Immigration law is one of the most complicated areas of law in existence. So, this project of what we're trying to do right now of putting lawyers in, you know, it shines a light on what's happening in the system. It allows for people like me to sort of spread stories about what these courts look like. And so it's important for people to have that accurate understanding of, and this is what the immigration courts have always looked like, even before Donald Trump was president. In terms of specific items, I would encourage people to follow Immigrant Defenders Law Center on Facebook. We often post action items, articles, things to keep people updated on what's happening. And oftentimes, individual action can be used on a specific case to help get someone out. A lot of times people raise bond money just through collective action. And we've had, I know when Sophia had a client that, you know, we were able to raise bond money pretty quickly. We've had clients that were able within a few hours to get them out of detention. Another fact, and this, I'll end with this, is that the likelihood of success in your deportation case also increases substantially if you can get out of custody. That is a huge factor. And so it's very important for people to get off of the detained docket, get onto the non-detained docket, because their likelihood of success increases.
Wow. I'm curious. You mentioned Sophia's client who had more, who raised money so quickly. Is there a reason behind that? Is there a difference in story? Because I remember what I was reading on the website when it said, immigrants with lawyers are 5 times more likely to prevail in their cases. That's a startling statistic and a tragic statistic. So I'm just curious, what was Sophia, was your client's story different? Or not that anyone matters more than another, but are there lessons to be learned from raising money that quickly for a certain client that can be applied to other clients?
Well, sadly, this client did represent kind of a change in detention policy post-election of erring on the fact of detaining more folks. So he did represent that new expansion in detaining folks that are even more vulnerable. So an asylum seeker, 18-year-old with no history prior to having family here that wanted to take him in, enough for bond and definitely for being just out of detention in the past, being taken in. So I think those factors, and we try to inform people of that fact through our fundraising efforts that, and sadly it did signify a change, and I think at that time we were also able to connect to certain built-in networks. Although I encourage people to get out, to join organizations where you can attend a meeting or be part of something larger, there is also a lot to be said for joining listservs and monitoring like our Facebook and being part of email chains. That actually, I do think made a huge difference in finding or quickly fundraising the bond for that client, is that we were able to tap into some of those existing networks. So I would really encourage folks to do that. And one of the new networks that has been growing is that for those folks that are out there that are lawyers or have any kind of immigration experience, there is a Los Angeles RAIDS Rapid Response Network. Folks are being trained. There's access to tutorials. To do a bond hearing, attorneys could get trained, and there's plenty of attorneys out there that do different areas of the law that wouldn't need to get, fully immersed in removal defense, because that is a big ask. But to do bond hearing, being trained by veteran attorneys is something that actually is very doable. So I would challenge the attorneys out there to, through our webpage, get connected with the Los Angeles RAIDS Rapid Response Network to outreach to us to say, hey, how can I volunteer? At times we've given out pro bono cases. And in terms of everyday, non-attorney folks, you folks really can make a difference by calling up representatives. Showing up at a protest action, people who have been summarily deported have even been brought back to the country because of people protesting. So people power can really make a difference right now, and especially in this climate where there's a lot of misinformation, you becoming informed, like Alana said, is crucial to then inform your friends and neighbors, right? Lots of folks out there have friends and neighbors that maybe are more fence-guarded on this issue or just misinformed, and you could probably be the one agent to change their mind.
Well, I just want to say thank you guys both for coming on. This is a conversation that we've been wanting to have more and more, so thank you both for doing the work that you're doing and spreading the word that you're doing, and hopefully we can raise more awareness to get more, as you said, people power involved. If you guys want to donate, you can go to immdef.org. There's a big green donate button, top right. And then the Facebook page, you said, so we can highlight it again?
It's the full name of our organization. So it's Immigrant Defenders Law Center.
Cool. So check that out and then get involved in any way you can. Any parting pieces of advice for people that might be getting involved in this type of work?
I would say, it's easy to get discouraged. There's lots of reasons to be discouraged, but, you know, at organizations like IMDEF, we are stopping deportations, you know, all the time. People are getting green cards, you know, we are having success on these cases as, you know, the data bears out globally. But I will just say that, you know, there are attorneys all over the country that are actually, you know, saving people from this. And there are people who get to stay with their families. The impact of that is real. And so remember that it's easy to get so bogged down by the news. But there are successes that are happening.
Cool.
Amazing. And Sophia, did you have any last words?
Yeah, I would just like to add that in terms of there's definitely concrete cases we're winning. You know, if you have any money to donate, your donation can really make a difference. It can help us to donate to represent one more person and change, you know, a life, a family's life. But then also I'd like to say that, you know, there was a time when California was enveloped in this rhetoric that we're having, or in this national debate that we're having now, right, where we had the whole Prop 187 where immigrants, especially brown poor immigrants, were really vilified. And I think even though we have a ways to go in California, we've really, really turned the page. And that's happened within my lifetime. So don't get discouraged. You know, we can really change this country if we stay on course.
Fantastic. Yeah.
Amazing. That's amazing. That's beautiful. I just got the chills.
Every week we interview people that just are above and beyond. Well, guys, thank you again so much. If you want to listen to more of our episodes and hear other amazing people talking about amazing work that they're doing, you can go to Apple Podcasts, type in We Rebel, give us a rating or what, subscribe or whatever. WeRebelPodcast@gmail.com, or We Rebel on Twitter. We are We Rebel on Instagram, and we are We Rebel in life. I don't know.
In life, all the time.
Guys, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
What's a Creative Podcast Network?
Welcome to the Clam Bake!
I'm Lindsay Stitho.
And I'm Angela Gullner.
It's the opposite of a sausage fest.
Just a bunch of vaginas talking feminism.
You got it. Every Monday.
On What's a Creative.
Stay tuned.
Tune in!